Twins rushed ahead, splashing each other thoughtlessly. But I was afraid. Even though I had fallen in love with the river, I could see that at his deepest point, the water lapped against my father's waist. That meant I would be submerged to my neck, and I would be swallowed. I thought about taking my mother's hand like a baby, but she was balancing a bundle on her head. All of my mother's hands were busy, and I was too proud to ask Joseph for his. I had no time to be afraid. The pack animals were at my back, forcing me ahead. So I entered the river and felt the water rise to my ankles and calves. The current felt like a caress on my knees and thighs. In an instant, my belly and chest were covered, and I giggled. There was nothing to fear. The water held no threat, only an embrace. I had no wish to break. I stood to one side as the ox passed, and then the rest of the animals. I moved my arms through the water, feeling them float on the surface, watching the waves and wake that followed my gesture. Here was magic, I thought. Here was something holy. I watched the sheep craning their necks high out of the water, the goats wide-eyed, barely touching the bottom with their hooves. And then came the dogs, who somehow possessed the trick of running through the water, pumping their legs and moving along, snorting but not suffering. Here was more magic. Our dogs could swim as well as Egyptians. Finally, Judah came up alongside me, looking as dubious of the water as I had felt just a few moments earlier. "Sister," he said, "wake up and walk with me. Here is my hand," he offered. But as I reached out to take it, I lost my footing and fell backward. Judah grabbed me and dragged. I was on my back, the sky above me, and I felt the water holding me up. "Hi!" A little shriek escaped from my mouth. "A river demon," I thought. "A river demon has hold of me." But Judah pulled me out onto the pebbles of the far bank, and I lost the wild lightness in my body. Later that night, when I lay down to sleep among the women, I told my mothers what I had seen and felt by the side of the river and then in the water during my crossing. Zilpah pronounced me bewitched by the river god. Leah reached out and squeezed my hand, reassuring us both. But Inna told me, "You are a child of water. Your spirit answered the spirit of the river. You must live by a river someday, Dina. Only by a river will you be happy." I loved every moment of the journey to Canaan. As long as I kept my spindle busy, my mothers didn't mind what I did or where I went. So I wandered from the front of the caravan to the back, trying to be everywhere and see everything. I remember little of the land or sky, which must have changed as we traveled. Once Rachel and Inna brought me with them to gather herbs and flowers, up a hill that grew steeper and more rugged as we headed south. I was amazed to see trees growing so thickly that women as slender as Rachel and Inna had to walk in single file to pass among them. I recall their curious needles that left my fingers smelling green all day. Best of all, I liked the sights of the road. There were caravans heading back to Egypt, loaded with cedar, lines of slaves headed for Damascus, and traders from Shechem headed for Carchemish near our old home. So many strange people passed by, men who were clean-shaven as boys, and huge, black, bare-chested men. Although there were fewer women on the road, I glimpsed mothers shrouded in black veils, naked slave girls, and a dancer who wore a breastplate made of copper coins. Joseph was as fascinated by the people as I, and he would sometimes run over to get a closer look at a particularly strange animal or costume. I was too shy to go with him, and my mothers would not have permitted it. My brother described what he saw, and we marveled over it all. I did not share my observations of my own family with Joseph, though. I felt like a thief, spying upon my parents and brothers, but I burned to know more about them, especially my father. Since Jacob walked with us for a little while every day, I watched him and noticed how he treated my mothers. He spoke to Leah about provisions and plans, and to Rachel about memories of his trip north to Haran. He was careful not to slight either woman in his attentions. Zilpah bowed her head when my father approached, and he responded in kind, but they rarely spoke. Jacob smiled at Bilhah as though she were his child. She was the only one he touched, running his hand over her soft black hair whenever he passed. It was an act of familiarity that seemed to express his fondness, but also proved her powerlessness as the least of his wives. Bilhah said nothing, but blushed deeply at these caresses. I noticed that Reuben's devotion to Bilhah had not faded over time. Most of my brothers, as they grew into their height and sprouted beards, loosened their childhood ties to mothers and aunties, all except Reuben, who liked to linger near the women, especially Bilhah. During the trip, he seemed to know where she was at every moment. When he called for her, she replied, "Yes, brother," even though he was her nephew. She never spoke of him to anyone, and I don't think I ever heard her give voice to his name, but I could see their abiding affection, and it made me glad. Reuben was easy to know, but Judah was restless. He had chosen his position behind the herd, but sometimes he pressed one of the younger brothers to take his post so he could wander. He would climb to the top of a rocky hill and shout down to us, then disappear until nightfall. "He's young for it, but that one's already hungry for a woman," Anna muttered to my mother one evening when Judah came to the fire later that night looking for his supper. I turned to Judah and realized that my brother's body had begun to take the shape of a man, his arms well muscled, his legs showing hair. He was the handsomest of all my brothers. His teeth were perfect, white and small. I remember this because he smiled so rarely, they were always a surprise. Years later, when I saw pearls for the first time, I thought of Judah's teeth. Looking at Judah as a man, I had the thought that Reuben was certainly of an age to marry and father children. Indeed, he was not much younger than Nomer, whose daughter was almost ready to walk. Simon and Levi were old enough to have wives, too. And then I understood another reason why we had left Haran, to get my brother's bride prices without Laban's sticky fingers getting in the way. When I asked my mother about this, she said, "Well, of course." But I was impressed with my own worldliness and insight. No one spoke of Laban anymore. As the days passed and the moon began to wane, it seemed we were free of my grandfather's grasp. Jacob had all but stopped visiting Judah at the rear of the herd, looking over his shoulder to see whether his father-in-law was coming. Instead, his thoughts turned toward Edom and his meeting with Esau, the brother whom he had not seen for 20 years, since the day he had stolen his father's blessing and fled. The farther we walked from Haran, the more Jacob spoke of Esau. On the day before the new moon, we stopped early in the afternoon to give us time to prepare the red tent and cook for the 3 days given to the women. Since we would stay in this place for more than one night, my father raised his tent as well. We were near a pretty little stream where wild garlic grew in profusion. The smell of bread soon filled the camp, and great pots of stew were prepared so that the men would have plenty to eat while my mothers retired from their service. My mothers and Uzna entered the woman's tent before the sun set. I stayed outside to help serve the men. I never worked harder in my life. It was no small task feeding 14 men and boys and 2 young children, not to mention the women inside. Much of the serving fell to me, since Sabatu was often nursing her baby. Anna had no patience for my brothers. I was proud to be feeding my family, doing the work of a grown woman. When we finally joined my mothers in the tent after dark, I was never so grateful for rest. I slept well and dreamed of wearing a crown and pouring water. Zilpah said these were sure signs that my womanhood was not far off. It was a sweet dream, but it ended the next morning in a nightmare haunted by Laban's voice. But it was no dream. My grandfather had arrived, demanding justice. "Give me the thief who took my idols," he bellowed. "Where are my teraphim?" I ran out of the tent just in time to see my father, the olive staff in his hand, stride up to meet Laban. Beor and Kemuel stood behind my grandfather, along with three bondsmen from Haran, who kept their eyes on the ground rather than look into the face of Jacob, whom they loved. "Whom do you call a thief?" my father demanded. "Whom do you accuse, you old fool? I served you for 20 years without pay, without honor. There was no thief in this place until you broke its peace." Laban was struck dumb by his son-in-law's tone. "I am the reason for your comfortable old age," Jacob said. "I have been an honest servant. I took nothing that was not mine. I have nothing here except that which you agreed was mine, and it was not fair payment for what I have given you. Your daughters are my wives and want none of you. Your grandsons are my sons and owe you nothing. While I stood on your land, I gave you honor you did not deserve. But now, I am not bound by the obligations of guests and hosts." By then, all my brothers had gathered behind Jacob, and together they looked like an army. Even Joseph held a staff in his hands. The air was brittle with hatred. Laban took a step back. "My son, why do you rebuke me?" he wheedled, his voice suddenly old and soft. "I am here only to say farewell to my beloved family, my daughters and my grandsons. We are kinsmen, you and I. You are my nephew, and I love you as a son. You misunderstood my words. I wish only to kiss my family and give you my blessing," he said, stretching his fingers wide, bowing his head like a dog showing submission. "Is not the God of Abram also the God of my fathers? He is great, to be sure. But, my son," Laban said, looking up into Jacob's face, "what of my other gods? What have you done with them?" "What do you mean?" my father said. Laban narrowed his eyes and answered, "My household gods have been stolen, and they disappeared upon your departure. I come to claim them for me and for my sons. Why do you wish to strip me of their protection? Do you fear their wrath, even though you worship the faceless one only?" My father spat at Laban's feet. "I took nothing. There is nothing in my household that belongs to you. There is no place for thieves under my tents." But Laban stood firm. "My teraphim are precious to me, nephew. I do not leave this place without them." At this, Jacob shrugged. "They are not here," he said. "See for yourself." And with that, he turned his back on Laban and walked away, into the woods and out of sight. Laban began his search. My brothers stood, their arms crossed against their chests, and watched as the old man untied every bundle, unfurled every rolled-up tent, sifted his fingers through every sack of grain, squeezed every wineskin. When he moved toward Jacob's tent, Simon and Levi tried to block his way, but Reuben motioned them aside. They followed Laban and watched as he rummaged through our father's blankets and even lifted the floor mat to kick at the earth in case a hole had been dug. The day wore on, and still Laban searched. I ran back and forth from where my grandfather hunted to the red tent, reporting what I saw to my mothers. Their faces stayed blank, but I knew they were worried. I had never seen women's hands working during the new moon, yet here every one of them was busy with her spindle. After Laban had ransacked my father's tent, there was nowhere left for him to search except the red tent, his eyes fixed upon the women's tent on the edge of the camp. It was unthinkable that a healthy man would walk of his own will inside that place during the head of the month. The men and boys stared to see if he would place himself among bleeding women, even worse, his own daughters. Laban muttered to himself as he approached the women's tent. At the door, he stopped and looked over his shoulder. He glared at his sons and grandsons. And then Laban opened the flap and walked in. Laban's hoarse breath was the only sound. He glanced around the tent nervously, not meeting any of the women's eyes. No one moved or spoke. Finally, and with great contempt, he said, "Bah!" and moved toward a pile of blankets. Rachel stood up from her place on the straw. She did not drop her eyes as she addressed her father. Indeed, she stared straight into his face, and without anger or fear or any apparent emotion, she said, "I took them, Father. I have all of the teraphim, all of your gods. They are here. I sit upon them. The teraphim of our family now bathe in my monthly blood, by which your household gods are polluted beyond redemption." "You can have them if you wish," Rachel continued calmly, as though she were speaking of trifling things. "I will dig them out and even wipe them off for you if you like, Father. But their magic has been turned against you. You are without their protection from this time forward." No one drew breath as Rachel spoke. Laban's eyes widened, and he began to tremble. He stared at his beautiful daughter, who seemed to glow in the rosy light that filtered through the tent. It was a long and terrible moment that ended when Laban turned and shuffled out of our sight. Outside in the light, he found himself facing Jacob, who had returned. "You found nothing," my father said, with supreme confidence. When Laban made no reply, Jacob continued, "There are no thieves in my tents. This will be our last meeting, old man. We are finished." Laban said nothing, but opened his palms wide and bowed his head in acquiescence. "Come," he said, "we will settle our case." My grandfather motioned for Jacob to follow him up the hill to his camp. My brothers followed to give witness. Laban and Jacob each selected 10 stones and layered them one upon another until they had created a cairn to mark the boundaries between them. Laban poured wine over it. Jacob poured oil upon it. Each man swore peace to the other, touching the other's thigh. Then Jacob turned and walked down the hill. It was the last time any of us saw Laban, which we counted as a blessing. Jacob was eager to be gone from the place, so the red tent was dismantled the next morning, and we continued our journey toward the land my father called home. My father was consumed with memories of Esau. Though it had been 20 years, Jacob could still see his brother's face when Esau finally understood the full meaning of what had befallen him. Not only had Jacob betrayed him by stealing his beloved father's blessing, it was clear that Rebekah had been behind it, the last of many proofs of her preference for her younger son. Jacob had watched his brother's face as Esau pieced together the family treason, and my father was ashamed. Jacob understood the pain in Esau's belly and knew if he had been in his brother's place, he too would have given chase with a drawn dagger. Jacob dwelt upon a vision of his terrible avenging brother, describing him daily to his sons, and to Leah, Rachel, and Bilhah during his nights with them. For now he raised his own tent, so he could be comforted by a woman until morning. Jacob's fear was so great that it had erased all memory of his brother's love, which had always been stronger than his short-lived rages. He forgot the times Esau had fed him and protected him, laughed with him and praised him. My father's fear made Esau into a demon of revenge, whom I imagined red as a fox with arms like tree trunks. This uncle haunted my dreams and turned the journey that I had loved into a forced march towards certain death. I was not the only one who walked in fear. There was no more singing on the road or in camp after my father began to tell his Esau stories. The journey was quiet in the days after we took final leave of Laban, and even Judah no longer wished to walk alone at the back of the herd. Soon there was another river to be crossed, and Esau was banished from my thoughts. I rejoiced to see flowing water again, and ran up to the river bank to put my face near the delicious smell and sound. My father, too, seemed refreshed by the sight of the river and by the task at hand. He declared we would make camp on the far side that night, and gathered his oldest sons around him to assign them their duties. Although the water was nowhere near as wide as it had been at the great river to the north, this river was deeper in the center and much faster. Leaves did not meander downstream, but rushed away as though chasing after swift prey. Our crossing had to be quick, as the sun was already beginning its descent. Inna and Zilpah poured an offering to the river god as the first of the animals were herded into the water and guided across. The smaller animals had to be taken two by two, and by the scruff of the neck, with a man on either side. The dogs worked until they were exhausted. We nearly lost one of them in the current, but Joseph grabbed him and became a momentary hero among his brothers. All of the men grew weary. Even Judah staggered from the effort of guiding frightened animals while withstanding a current that dragged at him. The river was generous, and none of the animals was lost. By the time the sun was resting on the tops of the trees, only the ox, donkeys, women, and babies remained. Reuben and Judah struggled with a terrified ox, who bellowed like an animal headed for slaughter. It took a long while for them to drag the beast across, and by then it was dusk. My mother and I were the last to be taken across, my hand in hers this time, so that I would not be stolen by the current. When we reached the far shore, it was dark, and only my father was left behind. Jacob called across the water. "Reuben," he said, and my brother replied, "I am here." "See to the animals," my father said. "Don't bother with a tent. The night is warm enough. I will cross with the first light. Be ready to leave." My mother was not pleased by Jacob's plan and told Reuben to call back to our father and offer to cross the river and spend the night with him. He would not permit it. "Tell your mother to sit on her fears. I am neither a child nor a doddering elder. I will sleep by myself under the sky as I did in my youth when I traveled north. Be ready to leave in the morning," said Jacob, and spoke no more. The moon was still new, so the night was dark. The water would have sweetened the air had not the wet coats of the animals muddied its perfume with musk. They bleated in their sleep, unused to being wet in the chill of the night. I tried to stay awake to listen to the music of the rushing water, but this time the splashing lulled me into a deep sleep. Everyone slept heavily. If my father cried out, no one heard him. Reuben was at the riverbank with Leah before sunrise to greet Jacob, but my father did not appear. The birds' greeting of the day had stilled, and the sun had begun to dry the dew, but there was no sign of him. At Leah's signal, Reuben, Simon, and Judah plunged into the water to seek their father. They found him beaten and naked in the middle of a brushy clearing, where the grass and bushes had been crushed and broken in a wide circle around him. Reuben ran back to us, shouting for a robe to cover our father, and then he carried him back across the stream. Uproar gave way to silence when Jacob was brought, senseless, lying in his son's arms, his left leg hanging at an awkward angle, as though it were no longer attached to his body. Inna rushed forward and ordered my father's tent raised. Bila built a fire. The men stood by with empty hands. Reuben had no answers to their questions, and they fell silent. Inna walked out of the tent and said, "Fever." Rachel ran for her herb kit. Inna gestured for Reuben to follow her back inside. And a few moments later, we heard the terrible animal scream as he guided our father's leg back into its place. The whimpering that followed was even worse. Unnoticed and unneeded, I sat outside the tent, watching Inna's resolute face and Rachel's flushed cheeks as they walked in and out. I saw my mother's lips press into a thin line as she bent her head to hear their reports. I listened through the walls of the tent while my father screamed at a blue river demon and marshaled an army of angels to fight against a mighty enemy that rose from the waters. Zilpah muttered incantations to Gula, and Inna sang of ancient gods whose names I had never heard. Nintinuga, Ninasina, Baba. I heard my father weep and beg for mercy from his brother. I heard Jacob, the father of 11 sons, call out for his mother, Ima! Ima! Like a lost child. I heard Inna hush him and encourage him to drink as though he were a swaddling baby. On that endless day, no one ate or worked. In the evening, I fell asleep in my place by the tent, my dreams shaped by my father's cries and my mother's murmurs. At dawn, I started awake and was greeted by the stillness. I jumped to my feet in terror, certain that my father was dead. Surely we would be captured by Esau and made into slaves. But as I began crying, Bilhah found me and held me. No, little one, she said, stroking my matted hair. He is well. He has recovered his sense, and he sleeps calmly now. Your mothers are sleeping too. They are so weary from their labors. By dusk of the second night after his ordeal, my father was well enough to sit by the door of his tent for the evening meal. His leg was still painful, and he could barely walk, but his eyes were clear and his hands were steady. I slept without fear again. We stayed for 2 months by the river Jabbok so that Jacob could heal. The women's tents were set up, and the bondsmen's too. Days took on an orderliness, with the men tending the herds while the women cooked. We built an oven with clay from the river, and it was good to have fresh bread again, moist and warm, instead of the dried stuff we had eaten on the road, which always tasted of dust. During the first days of Jacob's illness, 2 sheep were slaughtered to make strengthening broths from their bones, so there was meat for a while. The rare treat made it seem like a festival. But as my father recovered his health, his fear returned even greater than before and changed him. Jacob could speak of nothing else but his brother's revenge, and he saw the nighttime attack and his struggle with the army of angels as portents of the battle to come. He grew suspicious of any attempt to calm him and sent gentle Reuben away. Instead, he came to depend upon Levi, who let Jacob number his worries endlessly and nodded grimly at our father's direst predictions. Among themselves, my mothers pondered the meaning of Jacob's latest dream, so powerful that it had crossed over into this world. They debated Jacob's worries and plans. Should he attack? Was it a mistake to send a messenger to Esau? Would it not have been wiser to appeal to his father Isaac for help? Perhaps the women should send a messenger to Rebekah, who was not only their mother-in-law but their aunt as well. But they made no mention of the change in their husband's manner. The confident man had become tentative and cautious. The affectionate father had turned demanding and even cold. Perhaps they thought it a symptom of his illness, or perhaps they simply did not see what I saw. I grew to hate every mention of Esau, though after a time my fear gave way to boredom. My mothers did not even notice when I started avoiding their tents. They were too caught up in my father's unfolding story and speculations about what lay ahead, and there was little for me to do. All our wool was spun, and the looms would not be unpacked, so my hands were often idle. No one called for me to fetch water or carry wool, and there was no garden to weed. I was near the end of childhood, and I was freer than I had ever been or would be again. Joseph and I took to exploring the river. We walked its banks and watched the tiny fish that swarmed in its eddies. We hunted frogs, vivid green ones unlike any we'd ever seen. I picked wild herbs and salads. Joseph trapped grasshoppers to dip in honey. We bathed our feet in the cool, swift waters and splashed each other until we were dripping. We dried ourselves in the sun, and our clothes smelled like the breeze and the water of the Jabbok. One day, we walked upstream and discovered a natural bridge over the river, a path of flat stones that made for an easy crossing. With no one to forbid it, we crossed to the far side, and we soon realized that we had found the very place where our father had been wounded. we recognized the clearing he had described. The circle of 18 trees, the beaten-down grass, and the broken and bent bushes. We found a scorched place on the ground where a great fire had burned. The hairs on my neck stood on end, and Joseph took my hand in his, which was damp with fear. Looking up, we heard nothing. No bird song or whispering of leaves in the wind. The charred place gave off no smell, and even the sunlight seemed muted around us. The air seemed as dead as Rudy lying in the wadi. I wanted to leave, but I could not move. Joseph told me later that he would have fled too, but his feet were rooted in the earth. We lifted our eyes to the sky, wondering if our father's fearful angels would return. But the heavens remained empty. We stood like stones, waiting for something to happen. A loud crash from the circle of trees broke like thunder, and we shrieked, or at least we tried to cry out, but no sounds issued from our open mouths as a black boar ran out of the forest. He ran straight for us across the battered meadow. We screamed our silent scream again, nor was there any noise from the hooves of the beast, which moved at us with the speed of a gazelle. I thought we were about to die, and my eyes filled with pity for our mothers, and I heard Leah sobbing behind me. When I turned to find her, she was not there. Still, the spell had broken. My feet were free, and I ran back toward the river, pulling Joseph with a strength greater than my own. Perhaps there were angels on my side, too, I thought, as I reached the footstones and found my way over. Joseph slipped off the first rock and cut his foot. This time, his voice rang out in pain. The sound of his cry seemed to stop the boar in his tracks, and the animal fell as though struck by a spear. Joseph recovered his footing and scrambled back to the far shore, where I held out my hands to him, and we embraced, trembling, amid the sounds of the water, the rustling of leaves, and the terrified beating of our own hearts. "What was that place?" my brother asked, but I could only shake my head. We looked back to the boar and the clearing and the ring of trees, but the beast had vanished, and the scene now seemed ordinary and even beautiful. A bird flew across the horizon, chirping, and the trees swayed with the wind. I shuddered, and Joseph squeezed my hand. Without a word, we swore the day to secrecy. But my brother was never the same. From that night forward, he began to dream with the power of our father's dreams. At first, he spoke of his wondrous encounters with angels and demons, with dancing stars and talking beasts, to me only. Soon, his dreams were too big for my ears alone. Chapter 4. Joseph and I returned to camp, afraid we would be questioned about our absence, and worried about trying to keep what had happened from our keen-eyed mothers. But no one saw us come. All eyes were fixed upon a stranger who stood before Jacob. The man spoke in the clipped accents of the South, and the first words I heard from his mouth were, "My father." As I crept around to see the face of the messenger, I saw someone who could only be a kinsman. It was Eliphaz, Esau's oldest son and my cousin, who looked so much like Judah that I clapped my hand over my mouth to keep from blurting it out loud. He was as ruddy and handsome as Judah, though taller, as tall as Reuben, in fact. He spoke with Reuben's gestures, his head tilted to one side, his left arm wrapped around his waist, his right hand clenching and unclenching, as he brought us the news we had dreaded for so long. "My father arrives before dusk," said Eliphaz. "He comes with my brothers and with bondsmen and slaves, 40 in all, including the women. My mother is among them," he added, nodding toward my mothers, who smiled at the courtesy in spite of themselves. While Eliphaz spoke, my father's face was a mask, unchanging and impassive. In his heart, however, he railed and wept. Shattered now were his careful plans for dividing our numbers, so Esau could not destroy us in one attack. Useless, all those evenings spent directing my brothers as to which animals would be given as a peace offering and which animals should be hidden from Esau's grasp. My mothers had not even begun to separate and prepare the goods my father wanted to present to his older brother in hopes of appeasing his terrible anger. But now he was trapped, and he cursed himself for occupying his thoughts for too long with demons and angels and clouding his purpose, for now our tents were in an indefensible position, with the river blocking escape behind us. Jacob betrayed none of this to his nephew, however. He greeted Eliphaz with equal courtesy and thanked him for his message. He led him to his own tent, bade him rest, and called for food and drink. Leah went to prepare the meal. Rachel brought him barley beer, but the women did not rush so that Jacob could have time to think. While Eliphaz rested, Jacob found my mother and told her to get the women dressed in their finest robes and to prepare offerings. He had Reuben gather his brothers, also in their finest attire, but he directed that they gird themselves with hidden daggers so that Esau could not massacre them without some cost to himself. All of this was done swiftly, so that when Eliphaz rose from his meal, we were all arrayed and ready to leave. "It is not necessary, uncle," Eliphaz said. "My father comes to you. Why not receive him here in comfort?" But Jacob said no. "I must greet my brother in a manner fit for a man of his station. We go out to give him welcome." Leaving only the bondsmen and their wives behind, Jacob led us. Eliphaz walked at his side, followed by the animal offering, 12 strong goats and 18 healthy sheep, shepherded by my brothers. I saw Leah look back over her shoulder, and sadness and fear crossed her face, like clouds across the sun. But she put away her sorrow quickly and remade her countenance into a picture of serenity. We walked for only a short time, not even long enough for our long robes to grow dusty, before my father put down his staff. Esau was in sight on the far side of a gently sloping valley. Jacob walked out alone to greet his brother, and Esau did the same, as the retinues of grown sons followed at a little distance. From the hillside, I watched in terror as the two men came face to face. In an instant, my father was on the ground before his brother. For one awful moment, I thought he had been felled by an unseen arrow or spear. But then he rose to his knees and bowed low, prostrating himself in the dust again and again, 7 times in all. It was the greeting of a slave to a master. My mother looked away in shame. Apparently, my uncle was also distressed by his brother's display, for he leaned down and took Jacob by the arm, shaking his head from side to side. I was too far away to hear words, but we could see the two men talking to each other, first crouching near the ground, then standing. And then the unthinkable happened. Esau threw his arms around my father. My brothers immediately put their hands on the daggers hidden in their girdles. But Esau had moved not to harm his brother, but to kiss him. He gathered our father to his bosom in a long embrace, and when at last they let go of each other, Esau pushed Jacob on the shoulder, a gesture of boys at play. Then he ran his hand through our father's hair, and at that, both men laughed the same hearty laugh that proved they had shared their mother's womb, even though one was dark and one was fair. One was slender and one was stocky. My father said something to his brother, and again Esau held him to his chest. But this time, when they parted, there was no laughter. Reuben later said that their cheeks were wet with tears as they turned to walk back toward us. Their arms hung around each other's shoulders. I was amazed. Esau, the red-faced, bloodthirsty avenger, weeping in my father's arms? How could this man be the monster who haunted my dreams and chased the song from my brother's lips? My mother's exchanged glances of disbelief, but Inna's shoulders shook with silent laughter. "Your father was such a fool," she said weeks later in Sukkot as we retold the story of that day. "To fear such a baby-faced sweetling? to give us all nightmares over such a lamb as that. My father led Esau back to where we stood, and Jacob presented gifts to his brother. Our uncle dutifully declined them three times, and then dutifully accepted his brother's offerings, praising each one in the most flattering terms. The ceremony of the gifts took a long time, and I wanted only to get a closer look at the cousins who stood behind Esau, especially at the women, who wore necklaces and dozens of bracelets on their arms and ankles. After he had accepted the animals, the wool, the foodstuffs, and Jacob's second-best herding dog, Esau turned to his brother and asked, in what sounded like my father's own voice, "Who are these fine men?" So Jacob presented his sons, who bowed low before their uncle, as they had been instructed. "Here is Reuben, my firstborn, son of Leah, who stands there." My mother bowed her head very low, less to show respect, I think, than to keep Esau from noticing her mismatched eyes before he had counted all of her sons. "And here are more of Leah's children, Simon and Levi. This is Judah," my father said, clapping his fourth son on the shoulder. "You can see how your image was never far from my mind." Judah and Esau smiled at each other with the same smile. "Zebulun is also Leah's son, and there are her twins, Naphtali and Issachar." Esau bowed to my mother and said, "Leah is the mother of myriads." And Leah blushed with pride. Next, my father presented Joseph. "This is the youngest, the only son of my Rachel," he said, flaunting his fondness for my aunt. Esau nodded and looked at the favorite son and stared at Rachel's undiminished beauty. She stared back at him, still thunderstruck by the events of the day. Next, Jacob called out the name of Dan. "This is the son of Rachel's handmaid, Bilhah, and here are Gad and Asher, born to me by Leah's girl, Zilpah." It was the first time I had heard the distinctions between my brothers or my aunties made so clear or public. I saw the sons of the lesser wives whom the world called handmaids, and I saw how their heads dropped to be so named. But Esau knew what it was to be second, and he approached the lesser sons just as he had my other brothers, going to Dan, Gad, and Asher, taking their hands in greeting. The sons of Bilhah and Zilpah stood taller, and I was proud to have such an uncle. Now it was my father's turn to ask about the sons of Esau, who named them each with pride. "You have met Eliphaz already, my firstborn by Adat, who stands there," he said, pointing to a small, plump woman who wore a head covering made of hammered copper discs. "And here is Rehuel," said Esau, putting his arm around a thin, dark man with a full beard. "He is the son of Basmat," nodding at a sweet-faced woman who held a baby on her hip. "My little boys are Jeush, Jalam, and Korah. They stand with Basmat there, but they are the sons of Oholibamah, my youngest wife," Esau said. "She died last spring in childbirth." There was much craning of necks as introductions were made, but soon we were able to get a closer look as everyone began the short walk back to Jacob's riverside camp. My older brothers eyed their grown cousins, but did not speak. The women drew together and began the slow process of acquaintance. We found Esau's daughters among them, including Adat's two youngest. Indeed, Adat had borne many girls, some of whom were grown and mothers themselves, but Libby and Amat were still with her. They were not much older than I, but they ignored me because I still wore a child's dress, and they were women. Basmat was a kind stepmother to all of Oholibamah's children, especially to the baby girl Iti, who had cost Oholibamah her life. Basmat had lost so many babies, both boys and girls, she could barely number them. She had only the one son, Rehuel, and one living daughter, Tabia, who was just my height. Tabia and I fell into step beside each other, but kept quiet, not daring to disturb the solemn silence that fell upon the procession. It was late in the afternoon when we reached our tents. A messenger had been sent to tell the bondswomen to begin the evening meal, and we were greeted by the smell of baking bread and cooking meat. Still, there was much to be done before we could have the kind of feast called for by an occasion as great as the reconciliation of the sons of Isaac. The women fell to work, and Tobia was sent to help me collect wild onions along the river. We nodded our heads like dutiful daughters, but as soon as we faced away from our elders, I nearly laughed out loud. A wish had been granted. We could be alone. Tobia and I walked with great purpose toward the onion patch that I had picked bare the first day we had come to the Jabbok, and we found enough new shoots to fill her basket. But we decided that our mothers did not need to know how quickly we had finished, and we took advantage of our freedom, putting our feet into the water and pouring out the handful of stories that composed the memory of childhood. When I admired the copper bangles on her wrist, she told me her mother's life story. How Esau had been smitten by the lovely young Basmat when he saw her in the marketplace near Mamre, where our grandmother Rebecca lived. For a bride price, he had offered Basmat's father, in addition to the usual number of sheep and goats, no fewer than 40 copper bangles, so that her wrists and ankles should announce her beauty, he said. Esau loved Basmat, but she suffered at the hands of his first wife, Adat, who was jealous. Not even the stillbirths of Basmat's babies had softened Adat's heart. When I asked how they could celebrate the new moon together with so much anger in the house, Tobia said the women of her family did not mark the moon's death and rebirth together. That's another thing the grandmother hates about the wives of Esau, Tobia said. You know our grandmother? I asked. You know Rebecca? Yes, said my cousin. I saw her twice at barley harvests. The grandmother smiles at me, though she does not speak to my mother, nor Adat, nor did she take notice of Aholibamah when she was alive. The grandmother says hateful things about my mother, and that is wrong. My cousin knit her brow and her eyes filled with tears. But I love the grandmother's tent. It is so beautiful there, and even though she is the oldest woman I ever saw, her beauty is not erased. Tobia giggled and said, The grandmother tells me that I look like her, even though it is clear that I resemble my mother in every way. Tobia did seem a copy of Basmat, with her thin nose and glossy dark hair, her fragile wrists and ankles. But when I met Rebecca, I remembered my cousin's words and saw what the grandmother meant. It was Tobia's eyes that Rebecca could claim as her own. For my cousin's eyes were black and direct as arrows, where Basmat's were brown and always downcast. I told Tobia about the red tent and how my mother celebrated the new moon with cakes and songs and stories, leaving ill will outside for the duration of the darkness, and how I, the only daughter, had been permitted inside with them throughout my childhood, although it was against custom for anyone past weaning and not yet a woman to enter. At this, we both looked down upon our chests and pulled our tunics tight to compare what was happening to our bodies. Although neither of us was ready to suckle, it seemed that I would reach womanhood first. Tobia sighed, and I shrugged, and then we laughed until our eyes filled with tears, which made us laugh even more until we were rolling on the ground. When we caught our breath, we spoke of our brothers. Tobia said she did not know Eliphaz well, but that Rehuel was kind. Of the little boys, she hated Jeush, who pulled her hair at every turn and kicked her shins whenever he was sent to help her in the garden. I told her how Simon and Levi made Joseph and my other brothers abandon our games, and how they treated me like their personal servant, whose only duty it was to keep their wine cups filled. I even told her how I spit into their cups when I had the chance. I spoke of Reuben's kindness and Judah's beauty, and how Joseph and I had been nursed together. I was shocked when Tobia said she wanted no children. I have seen my mother cradle too many dead babes, she said, and I heard Oholibamah scream for 3 days before she gave up her life for Iti. I am not willing to suffer like that. Tobia said she wanted no part of marriage, but would rather serve at Mamre and change her name to Deborah. Or else, she said, she would sing at the altar of a great temple, like the one at Shechem. There I would become one of the consecrated women who weave for the gods and wear clean robes always. Then I will sleep alone, unless I choose to take a consort at the barley festival. I did not understand her desires. Indeed, I did not fully understand her words, since I knew nothing about temples or the women who serve there. For my part, I told Tabia I hoped for 10 strong children, like those my mother had borne, though I wanted 5 girls at least. It was the first time I had said these things aloud, and perhaps the first time I had even given them thought. But I spoke from my heart. "You have no fear of childbirth?" asked my cousin. "What of the pain? What if the baby dies?" I shook my head. "Midwives do not fear life," I said. And I realized that I had come to think of myself as Rachel's apprentice and Inna's granddaughter. Tabia and I stared into the water, and our words ebbed. We pondered the difference between us and wondered if our hopes would be fulfilled, and whether we would ever learn what happened to the other after our fathers took their leave. My thoughts flew back and forth like the shuttle on a great loom, so that when I finally heard my name in my mother's mouth, there was some anger in it. We had tarried too long. Tabia and I walked quickly, hand in hand, back to the cooking fires. My cousin and I did our best to stay together after that, watching our mothers circle one another with thinly veiled curiosity. They studied one another's clothes and recipes, politely asking one another to repeat their names, just one more time, if you please, to get the pronunciation right. I could see my mother's eyebrows rise at the Canaanites' women's use of salt, and I noticed a dot stiffen at the sight of Bilha adding a handful of fresh onions to her dried goat stew. But all judgments were masked under thin smiles amid the rush to prepare the feast. While the women readied the meal, Esau and Jacob disappeared within my father's tent. After the sons of Esau put up their tents for the night, they gathered near my father's door, where my brothers also stood. Reuben and Eliphaz exchanged pleasantries about their father's flocks, subtly comparing the number and health of each herd, sizing up each other's approach to pasturage and skills with dogs. Eliphaz seemed surprised that neither Reuben nor any of his brothers had yet married or sired children, but this was not a subject that Reuben would discuss with the son of Esau. There were long lulls in the conversation between the cousins, who kicked at the dirt and clenched and unclenched their fists in boredom. Finally, the flap to the tent opened and my father and Esau walked out, rubbing their eyes at the lingering brightness of the day, calling for wine and for the meal to begin. The two brothers sat on a blanket that Jacob himself spread. Their sons arranged themselves in self-conscious order of rank, Eliphaz and Reuben standing behind their fathers, Joseph and Korah sitting at their sides. As I ran back and forth, keeping the wine cups filled, I noticed how my brothers outnumbered Tabia's, and that they were much more handsome than the sons of Esau. Tabia served bread, while our mothers and their servants filled the men's plates until they could eat no more. Every woman noticed who had taken the most of her stew, her bread, her beer, and each man took pains to compliment the food served by his brothers' wives. Esau drank deeply of my mother's beer and favored Bilhah's oniony goat dish. Jacob ate little, but did his best to honor the food brought him by Basmat and Adat. When the men were done, the women and girls sat down. But, as happens with great meals, there was little appetite after the hours of stirring and tasting. The mothers were served by the slaves of Esau, 2 strong girls wearing small silver rings through holes in their upper ears. One of them was pregnant. Tabia whispered that it was Esau's seed, and if she bore a son, the girl would remove the upper earring and become a lesser wife. I stared at the strapping slave girl, her ankles as thick as Judah's, and then glanced at the slender Basmat and told Tabia that Esau's taste in wives was as generous as his other appetites. She started to giggle, but a glare from Adat stifled us. The light was starting to fade when Jacob and Esau began to tell stories. Our bondswomen brought lamps, and Esau's slaves kept them filled with oil. So the light from the flames danced upon the faces of my family, suddenly grown numerous. Tabia and I sat knee to knee, listening to the story of our great-grandfather Abram, who had left the ancient home in Ur, where the moon was worshipped in the name of Nana and Ningal, and gone to Haran, where the voice of El had come to him and directed him to Canaan. In the south, Abram had done great deeds, killing 1,000 men with a single blow, because El Abram had given him the power of 10,000. Jacob spoke of the beauty of Sarai, Abram's wife and a servant of Inanna, the daughter of Nana and Ningal. Inanna loved Sarai so well that the goddess came to her in the terebinth grove at Mamre and gave her a healthy son in the extremity of her life. That son was our grandfather Isaac, the husband of Rebecca, who was the niece of Sarai, the priestess. It was Rebecca, my grandmother, who divined for the people now at Sarai's holy grove in Mamre. Having recalled the family history in the proper fashion, my father and my uncle moved on to childhood stories, slapping each other on the back as they recalled the times they had slipped away from their mother's garden to play with the baby lambs, helping one another remember the names of their favorite dogs, the black, the dappled, and especially the three-legged wonder, a miraculous bitch that survived a jackal's attack and still herded with the best. It was wonderful to see my father's face as these stories spilled out. I could see him as a boy again, carefree, strong, willful. His reserve melted as Esau reminded him of a day they had fallen into a wadi and entered their mother's tent covered in thick gray mud. He laughed at the story about a time the brothers stole a whole day's worth of baking, ate themselves sick, and suffered a beating for it. After many stories, a satisfied hush fell over the company. We listened to the rustling of the herds and the jabbok's whispers. And then Esau began a song. My father broke into a wide grin and joined in, giving loud and lusty voice to the words of an unfamiliar herding song, all about the power of a certain ram. The women pinched their lips together as the verses continued, each one randier and bolder than the last. To my amazement, my brothers and our cousins knew every word and joined in, making a great shout of their voices and finishing with a whoop and then laughter. When the men were finished, Esau nodded to his first wife, who gave a sign that opened the mouths of his wives and daughters, his bondswomen and slave girls. It was a hymn to Anat, a name the Canaanite women used for Inanna, and it praised the goddess's prowess in war and her power in love. Their song was unlike anything I'd ever heard, and the hair on the back of my neck stood on end, as though Joseph were tickling me with a stalk of grass. But when I turned to rebuke him, I saw that he sat by our father's side, his eyes shining and fixed upon the singers. They sang the words in unison, yet somehow created a web of sound with their voices. It was like hearing a piece of fabric woven with all the colors of a rainbow. I did not know that such beauty could be formed by the human mouth. I had never heard harmony before. When they finished, I discovered tears in my eyes and saw that Zilpah's cheeks were wet too. Bilhah's lips were parted in admiration, and Rachel's eyes were closed to listen with perfect attention. The men applauded and asked for more. So Basmat began anew with a song about the harvest and the fullness of the earth. Tabia joined with them, and I